Podcasting is the most valuable audience that you can have.
It's kind of a hot place to start.
This story is great. This story is great. This story is great.
It's all about finding that zone of genius.
This guy who is a bodybuilder and an actor and a politician and this like world conqueror who is cutting off people's heads. Like clearly there's something real here.
That's super interesting.
When in doubt, just say something extraordinarily controversial.
That was truly generational showmanship.
When Mr. Beef goes into your DMs and he asks you to hop on a call, because he wants advice to figure out, you know, how to take over the world.
Is there a time when this show will end?
Are we rolling, Charles? Okay, because I have a question that, you know, maybe we'll just like throw this in somewhere and it's kind of a hot place to start. But so you study the best performers in history.
Right.
That's what your podcast, How to Take Over the World, is about.
Yeah.
It feels to me, and we were just talking about the NBA, where there's this crop of young stars, but no one remotely close to LeBron or Kobe or anything like that. And I think about this in music artists as well, the way that Taylor Swift and Drake sort of transcended everything. Do you think that we're moving towards an era where it's harder for us to have those transcendent talents?
Yeah.
Going forward?
I do. And there's something generational about it, because it's not just basketball. Actually, if you look at tennis too,
Nadal and
Federer and Djokovic, and like finally some other people are starting to win.
Yeah,
but it didn't happen on the timeline it should have, right? Like there was 10 years when there should have been someone younger than them who could knock them off, and it didn't happen. You're seeing the same thing across a lot of sports, you know, like Tom Brady being able to go into his mid 40s and win the Super Bowl. So,
and there is kind of the Mahomes thing, I guess, which would be the best counterpoint, but it just seems like stars are not as bright these days.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if that's like a cultural generation.
I don't know. That, I wonder. Kobe Bryant retired what? 4-6 years ago?
Kobe?
Yeah.
Kobe Bryant retired in 2016. That's 8 years ago.
Oh, wow.
First of all, second of all, what's your point about Kobe? I'm saying that like.
But he was a star that was, I mean, on a pedestal and very recognizable.
Right. But he came into the league in 1996.
And you're saying.
I'm saying these guys, like, they had this long.
I'd put Anthony Edwards there. Anthony Edwards and John Morant. John Morant had the potential. He fucked it up. But he was there.
I don't think either of those guys are. I mean, Kobe won 3 titles in a row at 21 years old.
I think like, what you see, too, like, one of the differences in the generations is you have young stars in the NBA. Giannis has won a championship.
Yeah.
And you have Tatum, who's a young star. You have Ja Morant, but none of these guys have the same killer attitude, of like a Kobe or even a LeBron, who doesn't have quite the attitude that Kobe and Michael did. But there is something missing there.
Do you think it's the mystique? There was a mystique around Kobe. There was a mystique around Jordan because social didn't exist.
I think there's something to be said for our generation. It's really not my generation, actually. I'm 35. But like the generation, Gen Z really grew up with social.
Yeah.
Like embedded into their lives. And so I think this like always being online, there's just this constant pressure to be nice.
Yeah.
And you just can't have a Kobe attitude if you're always being told like, be nice, don't ruffle feathers.
Right.
What about Conor McGregor?
Another guy that I would say was blew up in the mid-2010s from a different generation. I think every example, like he blew up in 2015 and he grew up in the 2000s.
Fair.
So,
I don't want to be old man over here, like shaking my fist at the sky, but I do think there's something there. Like
I'm
every now and
man.
Then you are going to find, I'm sure there'll be some like freaks of nature who come along who manage to have that attitude. It just seems like it's less common than it was.
Well, and the thing I was even tying it into is I think Drake and Taylor Swift, to have a male and a female artist, you know, both of them came onto the scene in the late 2000s. They are still the dominant artist in their space who I wouldn't say anyone's really challenged. Either. I mean, maybe like Ariana Grande or something like that, maybe Dua Lipa. I don't know. But Taylor Swift is unparalleled.
Yeah.
She came about in the 2000s. Drake is unparalleled, came about in the 2000s.
I think there's also like an element of you can freeze people in time. Like people don't age anymore. You look at Tom Cruise and he's out there making movies, and it's because they can do like enough plastic surgery and enough. Like I'm sure they're giving him HGH or whatever else to keep his body young too.
Yeah, dude, he's got a great 40 time for like
for being
like
how old 50. Is he?
Ice got dude.
He's
my
like
mom,
late 50s or something.
50s, yeah.
My mom always says they're the same age, and I think that's probably like not to out my mom, but like that's probably like around the 60 area. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet. Well, let's kick this off. Ben, appreciate you being here.
Yeah.
Joining Sweat Equity Podcast. I know you're in Austin for the Founders event. One, I want to give you your flowers to start the episode because what you're doing with How to Take Over the World, I think, is unparalleled. You're one of the best at doing research and then just talking to the mic and kind of getting everything that somebody wants to know about somebody out onto into the universe, out into the episode. So I want to give you your flowers there. The thing that I don't think people know is you've been filming and recording How to Take Over the World for nearly 7 years, right? Which is crazy because podcasts are hard to grow.
Podcasts are super
very hard to grow.
Yeah.
And how have you been persistent throughout that entire time when, I mean,
I tell most people who start a podcast, you shouldn't need this, you know, like you should be able to do this for fun, for free for a while because podcasting is the most valuable audience that you can have because people who listen to podcasts, it feels so intimate. It feels so personal. Yeah. You feel like you're really developing a relationship. They do the stuff you ask, if that makes sense. Like when you advertise, they're willing to go and check out your advertisers. When you put out a product, they'll go and buy it.
Yeah.
But the growth is really difficult because there's no algorithm, right? So it's kind of hand-to-hand combat. You got to rely on word of mouth, people telling other people. There are other things you can do too, but that's why podcasting is like worth working at. But yeah, I mean, I was doing it for, I mean, I paid money to podcast, you know, it was a net negative on my income for like 4 years.
Really?
Before I really started making money.
I mean, that's happening with us now. It's like, it's been a net negative. We're now talking with sponsors. But yeah, it's been a tough thing of like, we're shelling out $8,000 a month, like in that range with short form editors, a producer, et cetera, just to get it off the ground and get listeners. And it's a hard thing to grow. Yeah. It is so hard to grow.
Yeah.
It's an investment though. I mean, you know, audience building and stuff like that. We now have, you know, roughly 10,000 people that absolutely love listening to the podcast.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
That's super valuable compared to, you know, having zero in October where they're primarily consuming your content via written, you know?
Yeah.
And now they're listening to you. You're in their
ear. Yeah, we're in their ear for an hour roughly every year.
And I think especially for content creators who came up on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, they're used to that algorithm and they're used to, all right, like I put out great content and the audience comes, right? It should work. And so a lot of people, that's actually another thing that makes podcasting great is it just weeds out a lot of people who aren't willing to do the work for a long amount of time because that's kind of what it takes to find the audience.
Let's talk a little bit about those early days of the podcast. I mean, How to Take Over the World.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned 4 years, it was a net negative. Like, what were some of the things that you think took it from a net negative to a positive, maybe other than just time? Because I think time and market is super important.
Yeah. I mean, it was a net positive in my life. It was a net negative on my income. What took it from negative to positive? I mean, if you look at my growth trajectory, it was kind of slow, reliable. And the reason I kept going with it is because even within the first month, I had people reaching out to me saying, this is my favorite podcast, you know? And so the audience wasn't there yet, but the love was there.
The data, the feedback was there.
Yeah, the feedback was, and I thought, I love it. The reason I made it is I wanted this to exist.
Yeah.
Some people find it really valuable. There's got to be an audience for that.
Yeah.
So you see slow, steady growth, and then there's a few steps. And that is always when someone found it. Sahil Bloom, if you guys know him, he's got a big Twitter audience. He found it and shared it in his newsletter, and that did a nice little... And then little Sam Parr found it, shared it on My First Million once again. And then Mr. Beast found it and tweeted about it. And once again, another step.
That's actually a question I had in here. So I saw that Jack Appleby put out a tweet that was like, I'm looking for podcast recommendations. What do you got? And Mr. Beast said, ignore everything in here. Just listen to How to Take Over the World. What do your analytics look like after Mr. Beast puts out a tweet that says that it has 11,000 likes, probably 5 to 7 million impressions? What do your analytics look like?
What's so funny, the Mr. Beast effect is crazy. It's unlike anyone else, right? Because that was just a reply.
It was a reply.
To no offense to Jack, but like not a very big account.
Yeah.
And he didn't tag me, right? And the effect was, I mean, I don't have the analytics of the numbers on hand, but it was really big.
Yeah.
like
20,
a random reply.
10, 20,
and it's,
30.
It's still big. Yeah. Like people still go back and like that tweet because he has such insane fanatical fans that they'll go through his replies and look at every tweet for years because it's been years now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it was 2022.
Yeah.
It was 2022. Do you think it was like in the 20, 30,000 range of like just downloads within a week or?
I don't think it was within tens of thousands within a week, but it was thousands within a week. And over time, yeah, it's been
that's a big, yeah, it's still a big shout out.
Yeah.
As far as like those inflection points, do you feel like they compounded quite a bit? Because you mentioned Sahil first, Sam next, and then Mr. Beast. And it's like, did each one continuously get maybe more effective, or was it actually like a similar boost for each shout out?
Yeah. I think there's more surface area at that point. And also, a lot of people like kind of put two and two together, right? So maybe they hear it the first time and they don't check it out, and then they hear another person recommend it. So absolutely. I do think there's some like compounding effect.
Yeah.
To those shout outs.
Yeah. They come. I mean, that's like the biggest thing in marketing is like how many touch points can you get someone to right. end up converting? And it's like same thing, you know, keep hearing about this podcast and it's like, all right, fuck, now I got to take a listen.
Listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love what you're building now, because I think you're monetizing in a very smart way too. Like, you're not just monetizing via ad sponsorships. You have ad sponsorships, but you're also doing consulting, and you also built PodRamp. Do you think that is kind of the new wave of media, the new wave for media companies and how they monetize? Is it goes just from doing ad revenue and getting companies to pay to get in front of your audience to the new wave is you're launching your own products, you're launching your own brands, and you're monetizing on the back end of your audience?
100%. Yeah. That is the direction everything is going. It's so much easier to say than to do. It's actually really hard to build valuable products for your audience. But if you can, you create more value and you capture more value, because you're able to, you know exactly what your audience wants, right?
Yeah.
And so there's no loss between what's being advertised and what's being offered. And not only is there no loss in value offered, you capture all the value for yourself. So easier said than done, but it's definitely, all the smart creators are moving in that direction.
Were yeah. people coming to you with that problem? Like, hey, I don't know how to monetize my podcast. I want to launch a podcast. What do I do, et cetera, that gave you the idea to then launch PodRamp?
Yeah, I just had a bunch of people who were like, hey, I love your podcast. It doesn't sound like anything else out there. It's you take a totally different approach. I'd love to work with you.
Yeah.
So I put up my shingle, set up a little shop, PodRamp, to work with people, help them launch podcasts, and it's been good.
And then one thing that seems pretty distinct about your offer is that you only want to work with large creators, right? Is that kind of skipping the line, because it's the same thing? You don't want to work with like if you're an SEO agency and you can choose between a big client or like a local business that only has a small budget, obviously you want to, you know, choose the bigger client. Is it kind of the same thing with these large creators where if they can port over their audience to a podcast, it's going to help it, you know, get off the ground?
Or? It's also, that's part of it. It's also, I don't think I have totally unlocked the secret to audience growth. Like, yeah. as we just talked about, it's been pretty serendipitous for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I didn't want to offer is a product where we create a podcast for someone and then it's 50 downloads, yeah. 50 downloads. And then, like, I just want to feel good about the product that I'm creating for people.
Yeah.
And so that's why I wanted to work with people who had some sort of distribution to make sure that like this is something that's going to work for everyone.
So it's more about like optimization than like a launch pad in that case.
Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking about like, let's build a pod live on the show, right? Like one of these creators came on and we had to go from ideation to monetization to optimizing the show. Where do you start? Like, where do you start on the ideation process? How do you help someone find a unique idea and a different idea? Because like even what you're doing or what you're currently doing, it is different. You're just talking to, outside of the Mr. Beast interview, most of the times it's just you talking to the camera, right? It's just you talking to the mic.
Right.
How do you help somebody figure out what's a good idea versus, hey, like scratch that?
Yeah, so it really starts with what do you want to exist in the world that doesn't exist right now, mm-hmm. right? Well, let's start with an audience of one and build off of that. Most people just start with who do I want to talk to, or yep. who can I talk to, or I want an audience. And so I think more people need to think about the content from their side, whether that's a solo podcast or even if it's an interview podcast, like what are you bringing to the table, either in terms of research, in terms of like coming at that interview from a different angle and exposing something new yeah. About the way they work.
Yeah.
So we're always, I really shy away from, well, I've got a good network and we'll do some interviews.
Yeah.
Like, no, we need to think about the angle. There's yeah. a few exercises I do. So I said, I start with that one. What do you wish existed in the world? There's this idea I stole from this guy, Eric Newsom, who's like kind of an original OG podcast. We started with public radio and helped launch some of the, like, I think he was involved with Serial, like some of the really big early podcasts. And he talks about 4 points of differentiation, which is you can be differentiated on what your podcast is about. It can be differentiated on who it's for. You can differentiate on who it's by, like who you are as the host,
yeah.
or how the story is told. He said the mistake everyone makes is they differentiate on one of those things. So they're like, very authentic conversations or whatever. That's how the story is told. That's only one thing.
Yeah.
You need something else. Very authentic conversations about what? That needs to be differentiated as well. So if you find two of those things to differentiate on, okay, now you can find a niche audience and then you can start to grow from there.
So interesting, because a lot of these, you know, a trend we've seen a lot is the new media, which is athletes, you know, forming their own podcasts and having those unfiltered conversations that you're talking about, where you talk about, you know, Shannon Sharp, he brings on Johnny Manziel and gets Johnny to basically tell every story that was said on the Netflix documentary. But it's because Shannon Sharp was the interviewer. It's in a different setting. It's kind of a different medium. To your point, the person who was, you know, dictating the story and how it was going to get told was different. And then also just the content turned into it took a different turn. He was able to unlock some unique angles there by, you know, being maybe a little more of a bro with Johnny. Totally. He's like, I know you were smoking weed out there. It's just like, it's really, it makes you, like, I was a consumer of the first documentary on Netflix, but then I still wanted to double down and watch that Shannon Sharp interview as well. So
I think there's this real issue where great interviewers, actually great performers at anything, make it look easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's this funny effect where I was playing tennis the other day at BYU. I live really close to the campus for BYU. And I was playing next to the BYU team.
Oh, yeah.
And they got a good college tennis yeah. team. And man, it looks so hard. Like, I watch them hit the tennis ball and I'm like, wow, I could never do that. They, you know, they're moving so fast. They hit the ball so hard. And then I watch the pros and I'm like, I think I could do that. And it's because they're so smooth that they make it look easy.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it seems effortless and you're like, oh, that's not that hard. It's the same thing. People hear Joe Rogan and he's such a natural conversationalist that they're like, oh, this sounds easy. It's the opposite of easy. Yeah. He's so good. It's so hard to do what he does that only he could like make it look 100%. Effortless, right? And so people underestimate how difficult it is to have a really meaningful conversation.
But the good comes from practice at being bad.
Right? Yeah.
In many ways, like, they have the it factor, but that it factor isn't developed until you be very bad and then over and over again until you're good and then great and it's effortless.
Yes, you do need to develop it as well. I agree. Yeah.
Yes and no. I mean, so you've really, your network has expanded quite a bit, right? I mean, through the last, I don't know, of the How to Take Over the World and MFM, you've gotten to be around some really talented but also highly productive people.
Yeah.
Do you think that talent plays more of a role than any guru kind of wants to admit?
Yes.
It's pretty inconvenient for the guru to be like, yeah, you're not going to be able to do this shit because you're not me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Talent really does matter. I encourage most people to not think about it too much because it's really easy to get in your head about, like, I'm not as talented as XYZ, you know?
Yeah.
So I always say maximize your own potential and then let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah.
But there is, like, frankly, there is just an element of talent. How old are you guys?
29.
Yeah, 28.
See, like, that was the exact age for me when I figured it out. That, like, I had certain limitations. I think when you're really young, especially as a man, you're kind of like, dog, if I had just decided to be a secret agent, I would have been the biggest badass in the world. I could have killed anyone.
I could have killed Bin Laden. I
could have killed Bin Laden.
Could have fired that shot. That's
and then, like, it's really once you get into your, like, kind of mid to late 20s where you start to realize, like, oh.
Yeah.
Like in various areas of your life, you start to realize like there are levels and there are places where I am great and there are places where I can do things that other people cannot do.
Yeah. For sure.
And there are places where people can do stuff that I cannot do.
It's all about finding that zone of genius.
Totally.
Right? Like where you play that other people can't.
Right.
I mean, sports for both of us, you know, definitely levels that playing field pretty freaking early.
Yeah.
It's like I'm 17. You know, 17, just like going through an AAU tournament and like De'Aaron Fox is like this guy who's now in the NBA, you know, went number 5 in the NBA draft. He's literally a freshman in high school, and he's the best player in the entire gym.
Right.
You know, and that's just talent. That he works really hard. I'm not hating, but like, he was incredibly talented and different.
Yeah. So, I had the same thing happen to me. I went to a Miami Hurricanes camp, and I'm walking into the camp with my dad. I'm like, damn, dad, that is a huge DN. That is crazy. He's in high school. We get into the running back lines. All of a sudden, he's standing right in front of me. It was Derrick Henry. And I was like, holy shit, this is a running back?
Yeah.
Like, and then I look up his stats. It's like, he rushed for 4,000 yards last year. I'm like, yeah. What in the world? Like, I'm working my ass off. This dude's 6'4", 240, and he's 16. You know what I mean? It's like, what in the fuck?
Yeah.
It's tough.
It's good to recognize that about yourself. Like, it's healthy. It's also, like, it helps move you into places where it is your zone of genius, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. So tying it back to, like, maybe let's kind of try and build a pod on the show. Are there any people that you see in mainstream culture, whether it's celebrities or, you know, influencers, that you think they could easily port in, like, maybe a dream client of PodRamp? Do you have that short list of people that you really think could do something cool?
I don't really think about it that way. No, because I'm never like scanning and thinking about like, I would love to work with this person, this person. I more think about it like I have a bunch of ideas for shows that are in my head.
Yeah.
And I'm always hoping that someone will like kind of pick up the torch.
Yeah. You know?
What are some of those?
Well, so for example, look at Founders, which has been extremely successful. Look at How to Take Over the World, which has been quite successful. There's a lot of room. There's this concept, easy to play, hard to win. Hard to play, easy to win.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm going to have some conversations with my buddies. They'll be very authentic. We're very funny. Very easy, right? So it's super hard to win. It's hard to be as funny as Joe Rogan, who is a professional comedian, right? It's hard to be as insightful as Lex Fridman, who teaches at MIT, okay? Whereas I lock myself in a room and bang my head against a wall for 2 weeks straight, reading all these books and trying to learn everything I can about a person. And I don't think I'm the smartest or the most insightful guy, but I go through that work. And so it's a hard game to play. The barrier to entry is really high, and therefore it's easier to win. So I think more people should do exactly that. Like, I would love to see, like, where's the How to Take Over the World for literature, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to have read the Iliad and the Odyssey and Moby Dick and Hamlet, right? Who's the person who's just going to walk me through it and tell me exactly?
Who's going to spark notes it?
Dude, hits home so hard. David Perel is this creator here in town. He's got an awesome newsletter. You probably know him.
Yeah, I love
And I read his newsletter, and yesterday he was like, maybe you're not reading enough. So here's the list of books that you should be reading. I'm looking at it, and I'm like, damn, that's like 7,000 pages, dog. Like, I'm not getting there. Like, you know, so, and I know audiobooks are obviously huge, but I do just kind of want the spark notes. I'm not going to lie.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
And who's doing the How to Take Over the World for athletes?
I was just thinking that.
You know, like, who's doing the How to Take Over the World for musicians, for artists? Who are the people that are just get like, for politics, you know, who's going to like take you by the hand and show you if you want to be the president of the United States in 20 years, like this is the path you got to take.
Yeah.
So I think that's where a lot of my ideas center.
Is there a testing, like a testing period that you'd put these ideas through to see if there's content market fit?
I know the ideas have fit. Like, that doesn't mean that anyone who creates the podcast will find that fit.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, the idea behind my podcast or Founders is really simple. But can you find someone who's genuinely obsessed with it, who's going to put in that
next layer?
That next layer where you can just like feel the enthusiasm and the love jumping through the microphone?
Yeah.
That's the big question, is the idea is solid, and then you have to find the match in terms of the talent.
Yeah.
And that's when the magic happens. And to your point, like, yeah. I can't put a definitive timeline on it, but it's actually earlier rather than later that I can usually listen to a podcast and say, this is working or this is not working. Yeah.
Nice. I'm going to send you episode 4. So one thing that I'm super curious about, as you know, we do host podcasts, as people probably know in this recording, but like, so you guys, you, the Acquire guys, the Founders podcast, all of y'all are doing episodes around a subject that has probably a lot of search volume. And, you know, say There's, you know, Ozempic is one that the acquired guys recently did.
Right.
I dove into that. It was incredible. It's 4 hours. I can't get through more than 30 minutes. It doesn't matter. How much of a role does that search volume for a big topic play in A, your topic selection at all, if at all? And then B, do you think that really influences discovery from new users?
I know it does because I hear from a lot of people who say, I just searched Caesar podcast and then I found yours and I became a listener. So it matters. In terms of how I think about it, I follow my curiosity.
Yeah.
Right. The second that it stops being a passion project, I think it'll stop being interesting to people. But my curiosity, like, I'm a very curious person. I have a long list. I keep an actual list, and it's, you know, dozens of people long that I think, oh, all these people would be super interesting to do an episode on. And so if I found that I have done two in a row that are like kind of for me, maybe they're more niche and there's not going to be a lot of search volume on them, then I try and say, all right, let's pull in a Genghis Khan. Let's pull in a Joan of Arc. Let's pull in a Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah.
Who I'm still very curious about and very interested in, but I know there's going to be some search volume there.
And then to that search volume point, is that something you're researching through Google? Or is it more so your own kind of, you just know this person's going to have a lot of search
volume? I just know, although sometimes I don't. Like, I do get a little surprised sometimes, actually, of who people are really interested in and who people are not. But right now, I'm just doing it on gut feel. I don't research it.
Nice.
Would you start with audio only, video and audio, or video only? Like, how do you have any recommendations there? Because obviously, one costs a lot more and people would lean towards doing video and audio, but do you think it's smarter to just start audio till you find content market fit and then move into video and audio?
I think for a lot of people, it makes sense to go audio first. But having said that, when I started How to Take Over the World, I had a real vision for what I wanted this podcast to be. And that's because I was a huge podcast consumer.
Mm-hmm.
I loved podcasts. And so I had this very clear vision. I wasn't at the time a real YouTube consumer. And so that's why I avoided YouTube for a long time, is because I didn't know what a great How to Take Over the World YouTube channel would look like.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just say, if your vision includes video, then go straight to that. But if you see it in podcast terms, if that's what you would love, then there's no shame in starting audio only.
I think it'd be kind of cool to go into your background before How to Take Over the World. Just, you know, where you went to school, what your early career looked like. You know, one of the things I always loved about MFM is just diving into those guys' early days. They talked about it a lot. And I think that really builds affinity with your audience.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear about your background as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, I was born at the Kaiser Permanente Hospital in Walnut Creek, California.
Nice.
You too?
So I guess I will go back to high school. I was a terrible high school student.
Mm.
Just found it so boring, hated it, skipped class a lot.
Yeah.
Almost failed out. I would keep a 2.0 during the fall semester because that was when basketball season was.
Nice.
And then I wouldn't have a 2.0 in the spring. And anyways, I got pretty good test scores, so colleges let me in. I went to Utah State University.
Nice.
And that was a really good experience for me. As much as I hated high school, I actually really liked college.
Yeah.
College was super fun.
I mean, you're a naturally curious person too, and that probably allowed you to pursue some ideas.
Just the flexibility was really nice, right? Yeah. And if you engage your professors, they're usually curious people. Who I had, especially one really good professor, her name was Jeannie Johnson in political sciences, is what I majored in. And she really rubbed off on me. So I had a great experience there. And then I graduated and went into management consulting.
Mm.
That was maybe a little bit more like high school, like very structured, you know?
Yeah.
And that wasn't a great fit for me, but I kind of hacked through it for like 3 years, I think, I was in management consulting. I won't say I was the world's best consultant. I don't think so. And then I went into tech and was doing marketing brand management for a couple of years. And it was during that period that I started How to Take Over the World as a side project.
Mm.
And then in 2018 is when I was like, man, I love this. So I went and I took a job and started working in the podcasting industry.
Cool.
What sparked How to Take Over the World?
Yeah.
a company I was working for had recently been acquired, and you know, I'm sitting at home with nothing to do, and I was reading this biography of Napoleon, and I had this feeling, I didn't know how to describe, the expression I've come up with is ambition porn.
Yeah. Mm.
So in the same way that, like, with porn, you are like experience sexual satisfaction vicariously through someone else doing the act, or so I've been told. Like this was the same thing.
Yeah, dude, yeah. I honestly, like, I wouldn't know.
People have told us all about it.
Yeah.
And, but like the same thing for ambition. Like you see Napoleon with this rise and gaining more and more power coming up through the world, and you just like,
you almost feel fired up.
Yeah. You feel juiced up. Like it's happening to you. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I had this amazing like excitement for life and all this stuff I was learning. I just thought, man, I really want to capture this. At the same time, I was listening to Tim Ferriss' show. One of the OG podcasts, shout out to Tim.
Yeah.
Love his show. But he did like 3 or 4 interviews in a row that I just was not interested in the guest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking, who do I wish Tim would interview right now? And I realized I wish Tim could interview Napoleon.
Mm.
And so I thought, well, I could do that. I could be Tim Ferriss for dead people. And so that was kind of where the idea came from, was like, all right, I'm going to be Tim Ferriss for dead people. I'm going to go find like the most successful people throughout history and find out what it was that made them so successful and so great.
Yeah, that's incredible, dude. I want to dive into, so your episodes are so in-depth. Like they're so, so remarkably, it seems like you're able to find the nuggets that people otherwise don't find when they have the same passion for the subject. So I'd love to just talk about like how you structure your research even. Like how do you find these golden nuggets? What are some sources of inspiration? And like really finding truth in a lot of noise, which history is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about that process.
Yeah. So I read, it starts off, as I said, with curiosity. Like, okay, I want to know what was it that made this person. So it starts off with like a lot of Wikipedia and Googling and just like trying to get a feel for what their accomplishments are in life. And something will spark a like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I'll see a Da Vinci painting and I'll read an article and like, this is why his painting of St. John the Baptist is so amazing. And you look at the legs he does and compare him to Jesus's legs in the same painting and you realize what an incredible artist he was. And so it starts with that curiosity. It's like, okay. Then I go and I search for the biographies and you just see what's out there and read the reviews and try and get a feel for like, okay, what are the good sources for this? I'm not a historian, so I'm not going to go out there and like whatever, do original research and dig up manuscripts, right. But I'm reading biographies.
Yeah, so it's primarily book focused. There's not like a, you know, secret website even.
No. It's primarily book focused. So then I'm reading through those. At this point, I'm mostly using Readwise to take notes. And then in terms of how I structure it, I'm looking for those things that as I read it, like I just like started burning inside.
Yeah.
Right. Either like, those stories or those takeaways, especially when they relate to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I'm working on this episode right now about Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, sick.
Nice. And Schwarzenegger says, it's crazy. So when he's starting his rise in bodybuilding, he talks all about his vision and how he has this vision.
Mm-hmm.
And because he has such a strong vision, he has what I call the golden boy effect, which is people just help him for no reason, right? So he's 16 years old, but he's telling everyone, I want to be the world's greatest bodybuilder. Yeah. So he has neighbors who are like bringing him milk.
Yeah.
Who are like, yeah. All right, if you're gonna be the world's greatest bodybuilder, like you need protein,
yeah,
right?
You need some milk.
Yeah, and like you see like people lending him money in order to like go to competitions. And then, you know, he has to escape from a military base because he's in the army. And so he has nothing and someone lends him their posing trunks. Like people are just helping him for no reason. And then I'm reading about Genghis Khan, and Genghis Khan has the exact same thing, right? He's a slave, he gets captured, and this family like hides him and sets him free at great risk to themselves for no reason, right? Like they get no benefit from it. And Arnold talks all about vision, and then Genghis Khan has this quote, without the vision of a goal, a man cannot expect to manage his own affairs, let alone govern others. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
To see these like two points of connection, you just realize like, wow, this is a really powerful concept. If it's motivating this guy who is a bodybuilder and an actor and a politician and this like world conqueror who is cutting off people's heads, like clearly there's something real here. Yeah. So I look for those things that I find a common thread or things that really just like get my brain going. Mm. And then I'm inserting those into the outline.
Do you think people could create that same effect now with social, right? By being motivating, putting your vision out there and getting people to align with it to the fact that they just want to help you achieve that mission?
Yes, 100%. You know, I talk about how to take over the world as like a billboard. Someone else used the analogy of a lightning rod, which I really like. Mm. Like it's just attracting the right kind of energy, right? And so social is a great way to do that, of just let people know what it is that you're about, and people are going to like naturally kind of filter into your tribe.
Yeah. I mean, I think you see that with, you know, our buddy, Matt Choi. Yeah. Like the way that he structures his content, he's like, okay, day X of prepping for this marathon. And you know that all these people are coming to support him because ambition porn, they're like, I want to kind of run a marathon, but yeah, I don't actually want to run it. Let's let Matt run it. Dude, you know what would be really cool? Do you have any sort of database or like a kind of a repository of where you're keeping all those common threads?
No.
That'd be a sick manifesto or something.
I don't know if you guys, how close you guys pay attention to Founders, but he has released a product called Founders Notes, which is, he has just taken all of his notes and made it a product. So you can buy it and just have a searchable database of all of his notes.
Yeah.
And I think that's really aspirational.
Yeah.
That's something I'd like to do. I think that's a really good idea.
For sure.
I mean, do you ever pull from documentaries when you're doing research? Like, for example, the Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary. Are you going to pull anything from that?
Yeah. Rarely, but sometimes. The knowledge capture is a little more difficult, right? But for example, for Arnold, I did go back and I watched, have you seen Pumping Iron?
Yeah, we've all seen it.
Oh, yeah. Pumping Iron's great. So I went back and watched Pumping Iron. When there are good documentaries, I'll sometimes go and watch those. Yeah.
So after studying the richest and like most powerful people of all time, I have a question for you. Do you now believe in conspiracies more or less?
I probably believe in them more. Yeah.
The answer you wanted.
I mean, it's funny because, you know, the official narrative is like, yeah, there were all these conspiracies, and then they just magically stopped in like 1947 when OSS, the precursor to the CIA, was came around, you know, and since then there have been no big conspiracies. What I don't believe in is like people see conspiracies, which obviously exist, and then they want to make it into the overarching big global conspiracy, which does not exist. There are no Illuminati that are really running things.
Yeah.
Like the world really is in your control. But there are conspiracies in the world.
So no matrix.
Okay. Although I do think that to some extent the universe is programmable.
I'll just dive into that. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Or what makes you think that?
Experience. You know, I had this experience where I wrote down in a notebook 10 times. It's so woo-woo. I like hate to bring it up, but I wrote down in a notebook, how to take over the world will be a top 100 podcast. I started off saying it's going to be a top 10 history podcast, and I thought, I don't really care about history podcast. It's going to be a top 100 podcast overall. Wrote down 10 times every day for, I don't remember how long it was, because within the first year, that's when Sahil Sam found it, and boom, it started to pop, and I popped into the top 100 of podcasts.
Yeah.
So like, to some extent, I do think it's kind of cause and effect, but also like, just like found my podcast.
Well, if it is cause and effect, why does that discount it at all?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Because the outcome still remains the same if that's a medium.
Right. So we're not living in the Matrix, but it is programmable to a certain extent.
Yeah. And you know, you've studied a lot of, you just talked about how Arnold and Genghis Khan shared a vision or a priority for having a vision.
Right.
And that led to their success.
I think the thing that I would emphasize about this, and the reason it doesn't work for some people, is I'm out there saying how to take over the world is going to be one of the top 100 podcasts in the world. Literally everyone else is out there repeating in their mind subconsciously, no, it won't.
Yeah.
Right? Like other people are exerting their will subconsciously to keep things as they are. Like people favor the status quo. And so like, if you are going to program the universe, so to speak, your will has to be so strong and so powerful that it's going to overwhelm. Like, people want the world to stay as it is. But they don't care that deeply about it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah. So that if you come in very sharply with a very clear vision and a powerful will, then they're willing to bend their reality to what you want. Yeah. But you do have to want it very strongly and act very
strongly.
That's
something Sam always talks about, is like people that just bend the world or bend the reality to what they want.
Yeah.
So speaking of Sam, one of your coolest experiences was working on the My First Million podcast. What does a producer actually do?
Well, that's the funny thing, is a producer can do a lot of different
things. A lot of different roles. It could be near the editing, you're ideating, you can supporting when like, hey, like this thing you said, you should expand on it more. So I'm just like, I'd love to dive into what your actual role was on the podcast and how you interplayed with those guys.
Yeah. You know, I came into a podcast that was already successful, and I think it got marginally more successful while I was there. Yeah. Hopefully I had something to do with that. I think most of it, though, is like, that's the product of their genius, Sam and Sean, right?
Right.
As a producer, yeah, I was there thinking about what do we want to talk about? Although even that, they mostly source their own topics, but in terms of guests, you know, who's going to be good, who is not, let's filter for that for them. And then on the back end was a lot of it of how do we subtly craft this to make it more compelling?
Yeah.
I think we did a good job. So I think most people assume, and the current producer, I still listen, is very talented. Most people assume that organic flowing conversation is just how it comes out of their mouths. And they are very good conversationalists, but there's a lot of subtle adjustment, a lot of editing, a lot of moving around segments that goes into that to make it sound natural.
You know, as we've kind of built this, it's so clear. Like, we had an episode with Jordan Rogers, who is an ex Nike marketing director. We went for 2 hours
and
15 minutes.
Hours.
Yeah, we went for 2.5 hours. And like, there's a lot of like maybe lulls and moments where no one was, the energy was low, but then some topics would like reignite the conversation.
Yeah.
And that's probably the role of a producer and editor that a lot of people don't see.
One of my favorite things to do as a producer, this is just an example, I still do it for my PodRamp clients, is in interviews, I always like to ask guests about their early childhood first. Their background, because it's very easy to talk about and it gets them settled down and comfortable, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's the most compelling part of the interview, though. And so I'll start off asking about that, but I always make sure to put it like 30 minutes in.
So is it good that Brian asked you that about 20, 30 minutes into the podcast?
You can leave it there. Yeah.
Good job, bro. Yeah,
but I like to like get into just like, what's the most important thing you have to say? What's the highest value thing for my audience? And then once they're bought into that you have value to add, now they want to hear who you are.
Yeah.
Right. So like, that's a thing that you'll just hear and you think it came in that flow, but if it was one of my podcasts, it didn't actually come in that flow.
After producing on so many podcasts over the years, what do you think is some of the best tactics in interviewing to get really good value out of a guest? Like, do you want to go more specific? Do you want to craft the question way before, kind of with the end goal in mind? Or like, what's some of those best practices?
Yeah, so you want to be driving at specific things. It's very rare that you're interviewing someone for the first time in their life.
Yeah.
I don't have a ton of experience with that.
Yeah.
So usually there are other podcasts that you can go and listen to. And you can say, okay, you can really just map it out. This story is great. This story is great. This story is great. And so you're just driving towards those stories. And it's great if you can do so without, can you tell me the story of?
Yeah.
Because then it feels inorganic, right? Mm-hmm. But if you can ask something that you know will lead them to talk about that, that's great. So you're driving towards stories, or the best content is, you know, there's a story there, but they haven't told it, right? So, you know, I think about our interview, maybe I have told the story of like how to Take Over the World grew, but I don't know. That's something most people haven't heard, right? But you know there's a story there, right?
I have it on a Google Doc. That's what I wanted to know.
And so I just think of it as a series of stories, and you're trying to drive towards those, and you want to map it out in advance.
And it's really about following your curiosity. I mean, I think one, you know, it's hard to find you talking about that story and something, at least for me, I think a lot of people who listen to these podcasts, they probably just want to know selfishly, where were you at 27? I'm 27.
Right.
What were you doing at 27? How do I stack up? And I think that's really interesting for people.
Another thing that comes to mind is exactly what you just did, which is, so there are some people, David Center is actually a good example, who you can just put a microphone in front of and push play and then just like, I'm done here. Yeah, my work is done here, and let them go. But that's not most people.
Ambition porn.
Yeah. That's not most people. Most people, it's very uncomfortable to get on a microphone and talk for an hour straight, right? And so you have to give as well as take, right? Mm. So you make an interesting point. You talked about your football experience. You guys talked about where you went to college, and like sharing some stories of your own gets people going and makes it more of a conversation. Mm. Like the last thing I'll say that makes a really interesting interview is conflict is what drives story, right? And so if I ask you guys, how important is hard work? Your answer would be like, yeah, man, super important. Yeah. But if I ask you, you know, we all know hard work is important, but you know, Bill Gates said that he loves to hire lazy employees. I don't know if you guys have seen this quote, but he says, you know, a lazy employee is going to be the one who's going to find the shortest distance from A to B. They're going to be the ones who find the shortcuts, right? Mm. So if Bill Gates is trying to hire lazy employees, then why is hard work so important? Now you're like, well, I don't know. Let me think. And now you'll have some interesting thoughts about like the value of hard work. Yeah. And so introducing conflict, introducing the flip side of a point that someone is trying to make, that makes really engaging content because it gets people to think really deeply about topics.
That's super interesting.
Yeah, that was fucking awesome.
Now I'm like pondering what I'm thinking about hard work and why I think it's important versus
when in doubt, just say something extraordinarily controversial.
Yeah.
Hire lazy people.
Well, you know, and like, you know, if you've been thinking about something, it's usually you have been thinking about it because it's not obvious to you.
Yeah.
If it was obvious, then there's nothing to think about, dude, right?
So you just came up with that. What you just said would be an insanely cool short form clip. And I'm curious, are you pursuing short form on Instagram and YouTube Shorts? And what do you think that funnel would look like to your podcast?
So I'm not right now. I'm not doing short form. A lot of people ask me about it. I had this experience. I come into My First Million as the producer, all juiced up. And I'm like, guys, I got this great idea. I'm looking at our marketing budget. Give me $10,000 and I'm gonna put out a prize. Whoever can put out a clip with the most views gets $10,000.
Yeah.
So we do it. Say use hashtag MFM clips so that we can track it. MFM, by the way, stands for male, female, male. It's a type of porn. So we found that out the hard way that like if you Google MFM clips, just not great things you're
straight,
gonna find.
Straight double teams.
Yeah, straight double teams. Found that out the hard way, but the contest worked, right? People were tagging hashtag MFM clips, and we got like 50 million views in a month on these clips. And I was like, I am the man. So we're tracking attribution, and from those 50 million views that we got on TikTok and Instagram, we got like 120 to 130 subscribers.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
On YouTube or like the actual podcast?
On the actual podcast.
Because I feel like that was also during the time where you guys went from kind of 500, 600,000 downloads to surpassing 1 million downloads.
So we hadn't put as heavy of an emphasis on YouTube as eventually we would.
Yeah.
And maybe it would have worked somewhat better if we had been driving towards YouTube. Even then though, from what we saw, like with YouTube Shorts, like our Shorts viewers tended to stay Shorts viewers.
Yes.
And our long form tend to stay our long form. Yeah. So what I would say is maybe at some point I will go into short form, but when I do so, it's going to be to build a short form audience.
Yeah.
Because when people are in that high dopamine environment, they really don't like to click off and go find a podcast.
That's so fascinating. I had a guy that I know, Jack Settleman. He runs Snapback Sports, and they were the number one Snapchat show for sports. And he was kind of like an ESPN on Snapchat.
Yeah.
And he built I think it was something crazy, like 500,000 subscribers all on YouTube Shorts. And he would post long form. You're trying to do a sports show. You know, that was the funnel. And the long form was just not getting anything.
Yeah.
Because his subscribers didn't care about it. So he actually scrapped that channel and started anew with long form only, not focusing on shorts. And it's to your point. You have to, if the audience is expecting something and you try and deliver something else, almost like a Houdini,
right?
You know, you're rug pulling them.
Right.
And that's just not going to work.
Right.
Something I'm curious about is you've read hundreds of biographies, studied the world's top founders, inventors, creators, artists. If you had to make the world's greatest entrepreneur, what characteristics would you take from X person and Y to build that individual?
So pulling from specific other
people? Like you'd pull MJ's X, right? You'd pull Napoleon. LeBron, yeah, you'd pull something from Napoleon.
It's like build the perfect basketball player. It's like Kobe's mentality, MJ's mid-range.
Yeah, like LeBron's in 2K, you're creating a player and you get to pick like, you know, Steph Curry's shooting ability, et cetera. Like for the world's greatest entrepreneur, what are you pulling from specific individuals?
Yeah. I would pull like Steve Jobs' showmanship, mm-hmm. right? Like it's amazing that he died 12 years ago, something like that.
Dude, I think. Yeah. 2011. So 13 now.
And there's just still no one like him.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing that has replaced those Apple keynotes. Even Apple can't do it anymore.
Yeah. Oh, hell.
Like, not even that close. Was truly generational showmanship.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So Steve Jobs' showmanship. I think I would go like John D. Rockefeller's eye for detail. This is a guy who was managing,
right,
you know, in 2024 terms, like, yeah, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of business, and there's this great story. He goes in and he's with an accountant and he's like, mind if I take a look? That's what he would always say. Mind if I take a look? And the accountant's be like, I mean, you're the boss, okay?
The accountant just immediately, his heart sinks.
Yeah. And he would look through.
Heard that before.
He would look through and he'd be like, small error here. Hand it back and go on. And the accountant would be like, for the life of me, I double checked it. It was the only error in my accounting book and he found it in 2 minutes, wow, you know? Yeah. And it was like a $3 error.
Yeah.
And he had found it. So
that's
like
crazy.
That eye for detail, attention to detail is super important. So
not searching a database either, you know?
No.
Just like, going like off the rip.
Yeah, off the dome, like literally looking through an accounting book. So Rockefeller's eye for detail, Steve Jobs' showmanship. I think I would, Arnold Schwarzenegger is an underrated entrepreneur. I think I would go for his, I just talked about vision. Unbelievable at articulating really clearly a vision.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd steal that from Schwarzenegger. And then I would take, like you mentioned Kobe, Mamba mentality, baby. There's nothing like it. I love it.
No,
I would take Kobe's like killer instinct.
Piggybacking off of that, why do you think who you're trying to be is the most powerful question somebody could ask themselves?
You know, there's this story I love, two stories I love that I'll tell. So Julius Caesar is just like, he's, I think my age, he's like 35. He's a, oh gosh, I should get this right. Doesn't matter. Okay. He's a young Roman official. He's in Spain. He's been assigned there. And he sees the statue of Alexander the Great. And he starts crying. And his friends are like, dude, what is wrong with you? And he says, do I not have reason to weep when I think that at my age, Alexander the Great had conquered so many nations and I have as yet done nothing of repute. And so he freaks out, he starts crying, goes back to Rome, runs for consul, and then like starts his rise, becomes Julius Caesar.
Wow.
I read that, then I'm reading this biography of Thomas Edison, and he is a telegraph operator, one of the better telegraph operators, he's just an employee, and he is living with another telegraph operator. You know, he's young, he's younger than Julius Caesar, he's like in his early 20s, and he starts reading this biography of Michael Faraday, who was an inventor just the generation before Edison. And so his roommate goes to bed and he's reading this biography of Faraday, comes out in the morning, Edison's still there, still reading this biography. And he's like, whoa, you've been up all night. He throws down the biography and says, I'm 22 years old. Michael Faraday had accomplished so much by the time he was 22. I might live to be 50, is what he says. Will I be able to do what he did? I'm going to hustle. That's the phrase he used. I'm going to hustle. And then And then he gets obsessed with inventing, with being Michael Faraday. And then he starts his rise, he becomes Thomas Edison, invents the phonograph, invents the light bulb, becomes like one of the greatest, if not the greatest, inventor of all time. So there's just this amazing clarity. When you find who you want to be, it just strips away all of the question marks. You know, now all that's left is like, all right, well, I just got to go do it.
Yeah, the work.
Just all that's left is the work. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to so much clarity and so much focus, which is why I think it's the most powerful question that you can ask yourself.
And what happens along that journey when you're just facing failure after failure, but you know you can be that? How do those individuals go through that adversity?
You know, it is interesting. In reading through, there's this great book called Make Something Wonderful, I think it's called. It's Steve Jobs in his own words. Mm-hmm. And they went and they clipped out Steve Jobs in his own words, a bunch of speeches that he gave, a bunch of talks that he gave, a bunch of interviews he sat down for. And in one of them, he says, you know, you can't be afraid of failure. That's one thing I always tried to coach myself on. Mm. It's interesting. It's the only thing that he says that he actually had to coach himself on, because you know that failure is going to come and it's going to teach you something and you have to keep working through it. But like for everyone, it's the Mike Tyson effect, right? Everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the mm-hmm. face.
Yeah.
With everyone, as soon as you start failing, you just like, you tense up and you're like, oh, this feels bad, right? Yeah. And so it is something that like even the best entrepreneurs who have the most self-belief have to work on, because dealing with failure is really tricky. So the answer is like, you just have to keep going through it. You have to keep that vision, but it's going to take some coaching and some work to get through that failure.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be. That's, you know, that vision and that clarity that you mentioned before has to be the reason, your North Star. Without it, you're not going to believe in, oh, maybe this failure is just a step to getting to be that person versus, oh, this is, I'm done.
Right. The other rule I put with it is, so John D. Rockefeller had a really good vision for who he wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't go to college. So he goes to this little like ITT Tech, University of Phoenix type thing. It's like a 3-month business course to like get you the basics on like how to do business, right? So he does that for 3 months and he says, all right, I want to work in big business. So he lives in Cleveland. He's like, I want to work either for like a merchant house or a bank or like a big business. So he goes to all the big businesses and he applies to every single one in Cleveland and they all say no.
Wow.
And so he's like, okay, what do I do now? Like I had this plan and everyone said no. So what do you do? Like just put yourself in his shoes. What would you do? Everyone said no.
Yeah.
He just goes back. He just goes back to all the same businesses and is like, are you sure?
Yeah.
And so he goes a third time. And then finally on his third round, someone's like, all right, we'll give you a shot.
Yeah.
And so I think that's like the litmus test I try and give myself is, if I am clear on my vision, if I'm not, then like let failure teach you. Maybe this isn't what you want to do after all, or maybe you're not cut out for this, okay? So if your vision isn't clear, then like maybe let failure teach you. But if your vision is clear, like you know you want this, then just ask yourself, have I failed at least twice as much as any reasonable person could expect before I say like, all right, I'm going to adjust my plan or whatever, do something else.
That makes me think about the Michael Jordan quote where he's like, I've missed 500 game winners kind of thing. And it's like, when you compare that to how many game winners he's actually made, it's probably 50. You know, it's 10x of what he's actually made.
The quote is, I've failed over and over in my life, and that is why I succeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go look at like the list for top 10 most missed field goals in NBA history, all the greats are on there.
You'll find
Kobe's definitely not on there. I'm just kidding. Pure sarcasm.
He's number one.
He's got to be one.
The one last thing I wanted to ask you was, when Mr. Beast goes into your DMs and he asks you to hop on a call because he wants advice to figure out, you know, how to take over the world, and he's one of those outliers that he's going to be a Steve Jobs, he's going to be an Elon Musk. What is he asking you about? Like, what is the advice that he's seeking that's just going to make him better?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to out him too much, right? Because that's his business. But you know, I don't think when Mr. Beast called me, he wasn't like trying to solve something that he thought I could solve that he can't, right? I think what it is just, you know, it's interesting. People always ask me like, is there a time when this show will end?
Hmm.
And my answer is, why would I stop doing this?
Yeah.
Like, I get calls all the time from billionaires, from like famous people who want to talk to me because they're like, I am obsessed with biographies. Like, now that I've made it, now that I've cashed out, now that I'm rich, that's like all I do is read the biographies of these great and successful people. I'm like, I'm doing the thing that these people do once they retire, you know?
Yeah.
And they could do anything with their lives. And so I think they just want to live in that world of greatness. Like, they want to surround themselves with greatness. And I don't think they see that in me, but I think they see it reflected in me, if that makes sense. Like, I am sort of their conduit to these other lives.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what it is with Mr. Beast and these other people. Like, they don't think that I know something they don't know. They just think that, like, being around with that type of thinking is going to elevate their vision and their ambition.
Well, familiarity with a host is, you know, like, I think it's really important what you just said, the conduit. You know, you are the medium with which they are experiencing these biographies of people that they want to research themselves. You mentioned 4 points of differentiation. If it was a different person reading off the same script, it might not have the same impact on those people.
Right.
So, you know, the power of being, you know, this is like, I mean this in the least demeaning way, but like the Ryan Seacrest American Idol, you know what I mean? You know, it's like, once he was out of there, like, my mom was not interested, you know? So like, maybe there's a lot of value in being that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, man, I appreciate you coming. I know you have a flight and you got to get to lunch before you miss out on the founder's lunch. Where can everybody find you if they want to consume your content, if they want to work with you on PodRamp? Where can they find you?
Yeah, just How to Take Over the World, wherever you get your podcasts. Ben Wilson Tweets, if you want to follow me on social. And podramp.io if you want to work with me.
Sick. Nice. Awesome. Well, appreciate it, Ben.
Yeah, appreciate you, man.
Thanks, guys. Thank
you.
It's been great.
Yeah.